couldn't see how close he was to losing it entirely. He was seeing billions of sun-kissed lemons trotting toward these high cliffs, all of them wearing red jogging shorts and little white sneakers like M&Ms in a TV ad. "Yeah, but I wish I'd gotten into that fucking Microsoft in 82," Henry said. "Do you realize that shares that were selling for $15 back then are now selling for 35? Oh, man. Lemons," Elliot said dreamily, watching the sunset's colors begin to fade. At that point, he'd had less than a month to live in his world, the one where Co-op City was in Brooklyn and always had been. And Henry had less than a month to live, period. "Yeah," Henry had said, lying down beside him. "But man, I wish I could have gotten in back in 82. 15. Now, still holding Tower's hand, he said, "I'm from the future. You know that, don't you?" "I know that he says you are, yes." Tower jerked his head toward Roland, then tried to pull his hand free, and he held on. "Listen to me, Cal. If you listen and then act on what I tell you, you can earn what that vacant lot of yours would be worth on the real estate market 5, maybe even 10 times over." "Big talk from a man who isn't even wearing socks," Tower said, and once again tried to pull his hand free. Again, Eddie held it. Once he supposed he wouldn't have been able to do that, but his hands were stronger now, so was his will. "Big talk from a man who's seen the future," he corrected. "And the future is computers, Cal. The future is Microsoft. Can you remember that?" "I can," Aaron said. "Microsoft." "Never heard of it," Tower said. "No," Eddie agreed. "I don't think it even exists yet, but it will soon. And it's going to be huge. Computers, okay? Computers for everybody, or at least that was the plan, will be the plan. The guy in charge is Bill Gates. Always Bill, never William." It occurred to him briefly that since this world was different from the one in which he and Jake had grown up, the world of Claudia E. Inez Bachmann instead of Beryl Evans, that maybe the big computer genius here wouldn't be Gates. Could be someone named Chin Ho Fuck, for all Eddie knew. But he also knew that wasn't likely. This world was very close to his. Same cars, same brand names. Coke and Pepsi rather than Nozzle. Same people on the currency. He thought he could count on Bill Gates, not to mention Steve Jobsarino, showing up when he was supposed to. In one way, he didn't even care. Calvin Tower was, in many respects, a total shithead. On the other hand, Tower had stood up to Andolini and Balazar for as long as he had to. He'd held on to the vacant lot, and now Roland had the bill of sale in his pocket. They owed Tower a fair return for what he'd sold them. It had nothing to do with how much or how little they liked the guy, which was probably a good thing for old Cal. "This Microsoft stuff," Eddie said, "you can pick it up for $15 a share in 1982. By 1987, which is when I sort of went on permanent vacation, those shares will be worth 35 apiece. That's 100% gain, a little more." "Says you," Tower said, and finally succeeded in pulling his hand free.
"If he says so," Roland said, "it's the truth."
"Say thanks," Eddie said. It occurred to him that he was suggesting the Tower take a fairly big leap based on a stone junkie's observations, but he thought that in this case he could do that.
"Come on," Roland said, and made that twirling gesture with his fingers. "If we're going to see the writer, let's go."
Eddie slid behind the wheel of Cullum's car, suddenly sure that he would never see either Tower or Aaron Deepnow again. With the exception of Per Callahan, none of them would. The partings had begun. "Do well," he said to them. "May you do well."
"And you," Deepnow said.
"Yes," Tower said, and for once he didn't sound a bit grudging. "Good luck to you both. Long days and happy nights, or whatever it is."
There was just room to turn around without backing, and Eddie was glad. He wasn't quite ready for reverse, at least not yet. As Eddie drove back toward the Rocket Road, Roland looked over his shoulder and waved. This was highly unusual behavior for him, and the knowledge must have shown on Eddie's face.
"It's the end game now," Roland said. All I've worked for and waited for all the long years. The end is coming, I feel it. Don't you?
Eddie nodded. It was like that point in a piece of music when all the instruments begin rushing toward some inevitable crashing climax.
Susanna? Roland asked. Still alive? Mia?
Still in control.
The baby?
Still coming.
And Jake? Father Callahan?
Eddie stopped at the road, looked both ways, then made his turn.
No, he said. From them I haven't heard. What about you?
Roland shook his own head. From Jake, somewhere in the future with just an ex-Catholic priest and a belly bumbler for protection, there was only silence.
Roland hoped the boy was all right. For the time being, he could do no more.
Stave. Kamala, me, mine, you have to walk the line. When you finally get the thing you need, it makes you feel so fine.
Response.
Kamala, come nine, it makes you feel fine, but if you'd have the thing you need, you have to walk the line.
10th stanza. Susanna Mio, divided girl of mine. 1. John Fitzgerald Kennedy died this afternoon at Parkland Memorial Hospital. This voice, this grieving voice, Walter Cronkite's voice in a dream. America's last gunslinger is dead. Oh, Discordia. 2. As Mia left room 1919 of the New York Plaza Park, soon to be the Regal UN Plaza, a sombre North Central project, oh Discordia, Susanna fell into a swoon. From a swoon, she passed into a savage dream filled with savage news. 3. The next voice is that of Chet Huntley, co-anchor of the Huntley-Brinkley Report. It's also, in some way, she cannot understand, the voice of Andrew, her chauffeur. "Diem and you are dead," says that voice. "Now do slip the dogs of war, the tale of woe begins. From here the way to Jericho Hill is paved with blood and sin. Ah, Discordia, char you tree, come reap." Where am I? She looks around and sees a concrete wall packed with a jostling intaglio of names, slogans, and obscene drawings. In the middle, where anyone sitting on the bunk must see it, is this greeting. "Hello, nigger. Welcome to Oxford. Don't let the sun set on you here." The crotch of her slacks is damp. The underwear beneath is downright soaked, and she remembers why. Although the bail bondsman was notified well in advance, the cops held on to them as long as possible, cheerfully ignoring the increasing chorus of pleas for a bathroom break. No toilets in the cells, no sinks, not even a tin bucket. You didn't need to be a quiz kid on 21 to figure it out. They were supposed to piss in their pants, supposed to get in touch with their essential animal natures. And eventually she had. She, Odetta Holmes. "No," she thinks, "I am Susanna, Susanna Dean. I've been taken prisoner again, jailed again, but I am still I." She hears voices from beyond this wing of jail cells, voices which for her sum up the present. She's supposed to think they're coming from a TV out in the jail's office, she assumes, but it's got to be a trick. Or some ghoul's idea of a joke. Why else would Frank McGee be saying President Kennedy's brother, Bobby, is dead? Why would Dave Garraway from the Today Show be saying that the president's little boy is dead, that John John has been killed in a plane crash? What sort of awful lie is that to hear as you sit in a stinking southern jail with your wet underpants clinging to your crotch? Why is Buffalo Bob Smith of the Howdy Doody Show yelling, "Cowabunga, kids, Martin Luther King is dead"? And the kids all screaming back, "Kamala, come, yay, we love the things you say. Only good niggers a dead nigger, so kill a coon today." The bail bondsman will be here soon. That's what she needs to hold on to. That. She goes to the bars and grips them. Yes, this is Oxford town, all right. Oxford all over again. Two men dead by the light of the moon. Somebody better investigate soon. But she's going to get out, and she'll fly away. Fly away. Fly away home. And not long after that, there will be an entirely new world to explore. With a new person to love, and a new person to be. Kamala, come, come. The journey's just begun. Oh, but that's a lie. The journey is almost over. Her heart knows this. Down the hall, a door opens, and footsteps come clicking toward her. She looks in that direction, eagerly, hoping for the bondsman or a deputy with a ring of keys, but instead, it's a black woman in a pair of stolen shoes. It's her old self. It's Odetta Holmes. Didn't go to Morehouse, but did go to Columbia. And to all those coffee houses down in the village, and to the castle on the abyss, that house too. Listen to me, Odetta says. No one can get you out of this but yourself, girl. You want to enjoy those legs while you got 'em, honey. The voice she hears coming out of her mouth is rough and confrontational on top, scared underneath. The voice of Detta Walker. You're going to lose them for long. They're going to be cut off by the A-train. That fabled A-train, man named Jack Mort, going to push you off the platform in the Christopher Street station. Odetta looks at her calmly and says, the A-train doesn't stop there. It's never stopped there. What the fuck you talking about, bitch? Odetta is not fooled by the angry voice or the profanity. She knows who she's talking to, and she knows what she's talking about. The column of truth has a hole in it. These are not the voices of the gramophone, but those of our dead friends. There are ghosts in the rooms of ruin. Go back to the Dogon, Susanna. And remember what I say, only you can save yourself. Only you can lift yourself out of Discordia. 4. Now it's the voice of David Brinkley saying that someone named Stephen King was struck and killed by a Dodge minivan while walking near his home. King was 52, he says, the author of many novels, most notably The Stand, The Shining, and Salem's Lot. Ah, Discordia, Brinkley says. The world grows darker. 5. Odetta Holmes, the woman Susanna once was, points through the bars of the cell and past her. She says it again. Only you can save yourself. But the way of the gun is the way of damnation as well as salvation. In the end, there is no difference. Susanna turns to look where the finger is pointing, and is filled with horror at what she sees. The blood. Dear God, the blood. There is a bowl filled with blood, and in it some monstrous dead thing, a dead baby that's not human. And has she killed it herself? No, she screams. No, I will never. I will never. Then the gunslinger will die, and the dark tower will fall, says the terrible woman standing in the corridor, the terrible woman who is wearing Trudy Damascus's shoes. Discordia, indeed. Susanna closes her eyes. Can she make herself swoon? Can she swoon herself right out of this cell, this terrible world? She does. She falls forward into the darkness and the soft beeping of machinery, and the last voice she hears is that of Walter Cronkite, telling her that Diem and New are dead, astronaut Alan Shepard is dead, Lyndon Johnson is dead, Richard Nixon is dead, Elvis Presley is dead, Rock Hudson is dead, Roland of Gilead is dead, Eddie of New York is dead, Jake of New York is dead, the world is dead, the world's... The tower is falling, a trillion universes are merging, and all is discordia, all is ruin, all is ended. 6. Susanna opened her eyes and looked around, wildly, gasping for breath. She almost fell out of the chair in which she was sitting. It was one of those capable of rolling back and forth along the instrument panels filled with knobs and switches and blinking lights. Overhead were the black and white TV screens. She was back in the Dogon. Oxford, Diem and New are dead, had only been a dream. A dream within a dream, if you pleased. This was another, but marginally better. Most of the TV screens which had been showing pictures of Colubrin Sturgis the last time she'd been here were now broadcasting either snow or test patterns. On one, however, was the 19th floor corridor of the Plaza Park Hotel. The camera rolled down it toward the elevators, and Susanna realized that these were Mia's eyes she was looking through.
"My eyes," she thought.
Her anger was thin, but she sensed it could be fed, would have to be fed, if she was ever to regard the unspeakable thing she'd seen in her dream. The thing in the corner of her Oxford jail cell. The thing in the bowl of blood.
"They're my eyes. She hijacked them, that's all."
Another TV screen showed Mia arriving in the elevator lobby, examining the buttons, and then pushing the one marked with the down arrow.
"We're off to see the midwife,"
Susanna thought, looking grimly up at the screen, and then barked a short, humorless laugh.
"Oh, we're off to see the midwife. The wonderful midwife of Oz. Because of the wonderful things she does."
Here were the dials she'd reset at some considerable inconvenience. Hell, pain. Emotional temp, still at 72. The toggle switch marked chap, still turned to asleep, and in the monitor above it, the chap thus still in black and white like everything else. No sign of those disquieting blue eyes. The absurd labor force oven dial was still at 2, but she saw that most of the lights, which had been amber the last time she'd been in this room, had now turned red. There were more cracks in the floor, and the ancient dead soldier in the corner had lost his head. The increasingly heavy vibration of the machinery had toppled the skull from the top of its spine, and it now laughed up at the fluorescent lights in the ceiling. The needle on the Susanna Mio readout had reached the end of the yellow zone. As Susanna watched, it edged into the red.
"Danger, danger, Diem and New are dead. Papa Doc Duvalier is dead. Jackie Kennedy is dead."
She tried the controls one after another, confirming what she already knew. They were locked in place. Mia might not have been able to change the settings in the first place, but locking things up once those settings were to her liking? That much she had been able to do. There was a crackle and squall from the overhead speakers, loud enough to make her jump. Then, coming to her through heavy bursts of static, Eddie's voice. "Suze!
Hey!
Hear me?
Burn A. Do it before ever posed id. Do you hear me?"
On the screen she thought of as Mia Vision, the doors of the central elevator car opened. The hijacking mommy bitch got on. Susanna barely noticed. She snatched up the microphone and pushed the toggle switch on the side. "Eddie," she shouted, "I'm in 1999. The girls walk around with their bellies showing and their bra straps—" Christ, what was she blathering on about? She made a mighty effort to sweep her mind clear. "Eddie, I don't understand you. Say it again, sugar." For a moment there was nothing but more static, plus the occasional spooky wail of feedback. She was about to try the mic again when Eddie's voice returned, this time a little clearer.
"Burn up, day, Jake, pair, Cal. Hold on. Burn before she, to wherever she, have the kid. If you, knowledge."
"I hear you. I acknowledge that much," she cried.
She was clutching the silver mic so tightly that it trembled in her grasp.
"I'm in 1999, June of 1999, but I'm not understanding you as well as I need to, Shug. Say again and tell me if you're all right."
But Eddie was gone. After calling for him half a dozen times and getting nothing but that blur of static, she set the microphone down again and tried to figure out what he'd been trying to tell her, trying also to set aside her joy just in knowing that Eddie could still try to tell her anything.
"Burn up day," she said.
That part, at least, had come through loud and clear.
"Burn up the day, as in kill some time."
She thought that almost had to be right. Eddie wanted Susanna to slow Mia down. Maybe because Jake and Per Callahan were coming? About that part she wasn't so sure, and she didn't much like it anyway. Jake was a gunslinger, all right, but he was also only a kid. And Susanna had an idea that the Dixie Pig was full of very nasty people. Meanwhile, on Mia Vision, the elevator doors were opening again. The hijacking mommy bitch had reached the lobby. For the time being, Susanna put Eddie, Jake, and Pear Callahan out of her mind. She was recalling how Mia had refused to come forward, even when their Susanna Mio legs were threatening to disappear right out from under their shared Susanna Mio body. Because she was, to misquote some old poem or other, alone and afraid in a world she never made. Because she was shy. And my goodness, things in the lobby of the Plaza Park had changed while the hijacking mommy bitch had been upstairs waiting for her phone call. They had changed a lot. Susanna leaned forward with her elbows propped on the edge of the Dogon's main instrument panel and her chin propped on the palms of her hands. This might be interesting. 7. Mia stepped out of the elevator, then attempted to step right back in. She thumped against the doors instead, and hard enough to make her teeth come together with a little ivory click. She looked around, bewildered, at first not sure how it was that the little descending room had disappeared. Susanna, what happened to it? No answer from the dark-skinned woman, whose face she now wore, but Mia discovered she didn't actually need one. She could see the place where the door slid in and out. If she pushed the button, the door would probably open again, but she had to conquer her sudden strong desire to go back up to room 1919. Her business there was done. Her real business was somewhere beyond the lobby doors. She looked toward those doors with a sort of lip-biting dismay which may escalate into panic at a single rough word or angry look. She'd been upstairs for a little over an hour. And during that time, the lobby's early afternoon lull had ended. Half a dozen taxis from LaGuardia and Kennedy had pulled up in front of the hotel at roughly the same time. So had a Japanese tour bus from Newark Airport. The tour had originated in Sapporo and consisted of 50 couples with reservations at the Plaza Park. Now the lobby was rapidly filling with chattering people. Most had dark, slanted eyes and shiny black hair and were wearing oblong objects around their necks on straps. Every now and then, one would raise one of these objects and point it at someone else. There would be a brilliant flash, laughter, and cries of, "Domo! Domo!" There were three lines forming at the desk. The beautiful woman who'd checked Mia in during quieter times had been joined by two other clerks, all of them working like mad. The high-ceilinged lobby echoed with laughter and mingled conversation in some strange tongue that sounded to Mia like the twittering of birds. The banks of mirror glass added to the general confusion by making the lobby seem twice as full as it actually was. Mia cringed back, wondering what to do. "Front!" yelled a desk clerk and banged a bell. The sound seemed to shoot across Mia's confused thoughts like a silver arrow. "Front, please!" A grinning man, black hair slicked against his skull, yellow skin, slanting eyes behind round spectacles, came rushing up to Mia, holding one of the oblong flash things. Mia steeled herself to kill him if he attacked. "Ah, you take a picture of me and my wife?" Offering her the flash thing, wanting her to take it from him, Mia cringed away, wondering if it ran on radiation, if the flashes might hurt her baby. "Susanna, what do I do?" No answer. Of course not. She really couldn't expect Susanna's help after what had just happened, but the grinning man was still thrusting the flash machine at her. He looked a trifle puzzled, but mostly undaunted. "You take a picture, please?" And put the oblong thing in her hand. He stepped back and put his arm around a lady who looked exactly like him except for her shiny black hair, which was cut across her forehead in what Mia thought of as a wench clip. Even the round glasses were the same. "No," Mia said. "No, cry pardon, no." The panic was very close now and very bright, whirling and gibbering right in front of her. "You take a picture, we kill a baby." And Mia's impulse was to drop the oblong flasher on the floor. That might break it, however, and release the deviltry that powered the flashes. She put it down carefully instead, smiling apologetically at the astonished Japanese couple. The man still had his arm around his wife,
and hurried across the lobby in the direction of the little shop. Even the piano music had changed. Instead of the former soothing melodies, it was pounding out something jagged and dissonant, a kind of musical headache.
"I need a shirt because there's blood on this one. I'll get the shirt and then I'll go to the Dixie Pig, 61st and Lexingworth. Lexington, and then I'll have my baby. I'll have my baby, and all this confusion will end. I'll think of how I was afraid, and I'll laugh."
But the shop was also full. Japanese women examined souvenirs and twittered to each other in their bird language while they waited for their husbands to get them checked in. Mio could see a counter stacked with shirts, but there were women all around it examining them. And there was another line at the counter.
"Susanna, what should I do? You've got to help me."
No answer. She was in there, Mia could feel her, but she would not help. And really, she thought, would I if I were in her position?
Well, perhaps she would.
Someone would have to offer her the right inducement, of course, but... "The only inducement I want from you is the truth," Susanna said coldly. Someone brushed against Mia as she stood in the door to the shop, and she turned, her hands coming up. If it was an enemy, or some enemy of her chap, she would claw his eyes out.
"Sorry," said a smiling, black-haired woman.
Like the man, she was holding out one of the oblong flash things. In the middle was a circular glass eye that stared at Mia. She could see her own face in it, small and dark and bewildered.
"You take picture, please? Take picture me and my friend?"
Mia had no idea what the woman was saying, or what she wanted, or what the flashmakers were supposed to do. She only knew that there were too many people. They were everywhere. This was a madhouse. Through the shop window, she could see that the front of the hotel was likewise thronged. There were yellow cars and long black cars with windows you couldn't look into, although the people inside could doubtless look out, and a huge silver conveyance that sat rumbling at the curb. Two men in green uniforms were in the street blowing silver whistles. Somewhere close by, something began to rattle loudly. To Mia, who had never heard a jackhammer, it sounded like a speed-shooter gun, but no one outside was throwing himself to the sidewalk. No one even looked alarmed. How was she supposed to get to the Dixie Pig on her own? Richard P. Sayre had said he was sure Susanna could help her find it, but Susanna had fallen stubbornly silent, and Mia herself was on the verge of losing control entirely. Then Susanna spoke up again. "If I help you a little now, get you to a quiet place where you can catch your breath and at least do something about your shirt, will you give me some straight answers?"
"About what?"
"About the baby, Mia, and about the mother, about you."
"I did."
"I don't think so. I don't think you're any more elemental than, well, than I am. I want the truth."
"Why?"
"I want the truth," Susanna repeated, and then fell silent, refusing to respond to any more of Mia's questions. And when yet another grinning little man approached her with yet another flash thing, Mia's nerve broke. Right now, just getting across the hotel lobby looked like more than she could manage on her own. How was she supposed to get all the way to this Dixie Pig place, after so many years in Fedic Discordia, the castle on the abyss? To be among so many people made her feel like screaming. And after all, why not tell the dark-skinned woman what little she knew? She, Mia, daughter of none, mother of one, was firmly in charge. What harm in a little truth-telling?
"All right," she said. "I'll do as you ask, Susanna, or Odetta, or whoever you are. Just help me. Get me out of here."
Susanna Dean came forward. 8. There was a women's restroom adjacent to the hotel bar around the corner from the piano player. Two of the yellow-skinned, black-haired ladies with the tipped eyes were at the basins, one washing her hands, the other fixing her hair, both of them twittering in their birdie lingo. Neither paid any attention to the Kokujin lady who went past them and to the stalls. A moment later, they left her in blessed silence, except for the faint music drifting down from the overhead speakers. Mia saw how the latch worked and engaged it. She was about to sit down on the toilet seat when Susanna said, "Turn it inside out."
"What?"
"The shirt, woman, turn it inside out for your father's sake." For a moment, Mia didn't. She was too stunned. The shirt was a rough-woven kalam ka, the sort of simple pullover favored by both sexes in the rice-growing country during cooler weather. It had what Odetta Holmes would have called a boat neck. No buttons, so yes, it could very easily be turned inside out, but Susanna, clearly impatient, are you going to stand there, Kamala Moon, all day? Turn it inside out, and tuck it into your jeans this time.
Why?
It'll give you a different look, Susanna replied promptly, but that wasn't the reason. What she wanted was a look at herself below the waist. If her legs were Mia's, then they were quite probably white legs. She was fascinated and a little sickened by the idea that she had become a kind of two-tone half-breed. Mia paused a moment longer, fingertips rubbing the rough weave of the shirt above the worst of the bloodstains, which was over her left breast, over her heart. Turn it inside out. In the lobby, a dozen half-baked ideas had gone through her head. Using the scrimshaw turtle to fascinate the people in the shop had probably been the only one even close to workable. But simply turning the damn thing inside out hadn't been one of them. Which only showed, she supposed, how close to total panic she had been. But now, did she need Susanna for the brief time she would be in this overcrowded and disorienting city, which was so different from the quiet rooms of the castle and the quiet streets of Fedic? Just to get from here to 61st Street and Lexingworth? Lexington, said the woman trapped inside her. Lexington. You keep forgetting that, don't you? Yes. Yes, she did. And there was no reason to forget such a simple thing. Maybe she hadn't been to Morehouse or no house, but she wasn't stupid. So why? What? She demanded suddenly. What are you smiling about? Nothing, said the woman inside. But she was still smiling. Almost grinning, Mia could feel it, and she didn't like it. Upstairs in room 1919, Susanna had been screaming at her in a mixture of terror and fury, accusing Mia of betraying the man she loved and the one she followed. Which had been true enough to make Mia ashamed. She didn't enjoy feeling that way, but she'd liked the woman inside better when she was howling and crying and totally discombobulated. The smile made her nervous. This version of the brown-skinned woman was trying to turn the tables on her. Maybe he thought she had turned the tables, which was impossible, of course. She was under the protection of the king. But tell me why you're smiling. Oh, it don't amount to much, Susanna said, only now she sounded like the other one, whose name was Detta. Mia did more than dislike that one. She was a little afraid of that one. It's just that there was this fella named Sigmund Freud, honey child. Honky muffa, but not stupid. And he said that when someone always be forgetting something, might be because that person wanna be forgetting it. That's stupid, Mia said coldly. Beyond the stall where she was having this mental conversation, the door opened and two more ladies came in, no, at least three and maybe four, twittering in their birdie language and giggling in a way that made Mia clamp her teeth together. Why would I want to forget the place where they're waiting to help me have my baby? Well, this Freud, this smart cigar smoker, Viennese honky muffa, he claimed that we got this mind under our mind. He called it the unconscious or subconscious or some fucking conscious. Now, I ain't claiming there is such a thing, only that he say there was. Burn up the day, Eddie had told her. That much she was sure of, and she would do her best, only hoping that she wasn't working on getting Jake and Callahan killed by doing it. Old Honky Freud, Detta went on, he say in lots of ways the subconscious or unconscious mind smarter than the one on top. Cut through the bullshit faster than the one on top, and maybe yours understand what I've been telling you all along. That your friend Sayre, nothing but a lying right-ass motherfucker, gonna steal your baby and, I don't know, maybe cut it up in this bowl and then feed it to the vampires like they was dogs, and that baby nothing but a big-ass bowl of Alpo or puring the vampire Shut up! Shut up your lying face! Out at the basins, the birdie women laughed so shrilly that Mia felt her eyeballs shiver and threatened to liquefy in their sockets. She wanted to rush out and seize their heads and drive them into the mirrors, wanted to do it again and again until their blood was splashed all the way up to the ceiling and their brains. Temper, temper, said the woman inside. And now it sounded like Susanna again. She lies. That bitch lies. No, Susanna replied, and the conviction in that single short word
was enough to send an arrow of fear into Mia's heart. She says what's on her mind. No argument there. But she doesn't lie. Go on, Mia. Turn your shirt inside out. With a final eye-watering burst of laughter, the Birdie women left the bathroom. Mia pulled the shirt off over her head, baring Susanna's breasts, which were the color of coffee, with just the smallest splash of milk added in. Her nipples, which had always been as small as berries, were now much larger, nipples craving a mouth. There were only the faintest maroon spots on the inside of the shirt. Mia put it back on, then unbuttoned the front of her jeans so she could tuck it in. Susanna stared, fascinated, at the point just above her pubic thatch. Here, her skin lightened to a color that might have been milk with the smallest splash of coffee added in. Below were the white legs of the woman she'd met on the castle allure. Susanna knew that if Mia lowered her jeans all the way, she'd see the scabbed and scratched shins she had already observed as Mia, the real Mia, looked out over Discordia toward the red glow marking the castle of the king. Something about this frightened Susanna terribly. And after a moment's consideration, it took no longer, the reason came to her. If Mia had only replaced those parts of her legs that Odetta Holmes had lost to the subway train when Jack Mort pushed her onto the tracks, she would have been white only from the knees or so down, but her thighs were white too, and her groin area was turning. What strange lycanthropy was this? "The body still in kind," Detta replied cheerfully. "Pretty soon you'll be having a white belly, white breasts, white neck, white cheeks." "Stop it," Susanna warned, but when had Detta Walker ever listened to her warnings, hers or anybody's? "And then, last of all, you have a white brain, girl, a Mia brain, and won't that be fine? So, you'll be all Mia then. Nobody give you no shit if you want to ride right up front on the bus." Then the shirt was drawn over her hips. The jeans were again buttoned up. Mia sat down on the toilet ring that way. In front of her, scrawled on the door, was this graffito: "Bango Skank awaits the king." "Who is this Bango Skank?" Mia asked. "I have no idea. I think..." It was hard, but Mia forced herself. "I think I owe you a word of thanks." Susanna's response was cold and immediate. "Thank me with the truth. First tell me why you'd help me at all after I..." This time Mia couldn't finish. She liked to think of herself as brave as she had to be in the service of her chap, at least. But this time she couldn't finish. "After you betrayed the man I love to men who are, when you get right down to it, foot soldiers of the Crimson King? After you decided it would be all right for them to kill mine so long as you could keep yours, is that what you want to know?" Mia hated to hear it spoken of that way, but bore it. Had to bear it. "Yes, lady, if you like." It was the other one who replied this time, in that voice, harsh, cawing, laughing, triumphant, and hateful. That was even worse than the shrill laughter of the Birdie women, worse by far. "Because my boys got away, that's why. Fuck those honkies, most righteous. The ones they didn't shoot all blow to smithereens." Mia felt a deep stirring of unease. Whether it was true or not, the bad laughing woman clearly believed it was true. And if Roland and Eddie Dean were still out there, wasn't it possible the Crimson King wasn't as strong, as all-powerful as she'd been told? Wasn't it even possible that she had been misled about... stop it, you can't think that way. There's another reason I helped. The harsh one was gone, and the other was back, at least for now.
What?
"It's my baby, too," Susanna said. "I don't want it killed."
"I don't believe you."
But she did, because the woman inside was right. Mordred Deschain of Gilead and Discordia belonged to both of them. The bad one might not care, but the other, Susanna, clearly felt the chap's tidal pull. And if she was right about Sayre and whoever waited for her at the Dixie Pig, if they were liars and cousiners...
"Stop it! Stop! I have nowhere else to go but to them."
"You do," Susanna said quickly. "With Black 13, you can go anywhere."
"You don't understand. He'd follow me. Follow it."
"You're right. I don't understand." She actually did, or thought she did, but "burn up the day," he'd said.
"All right. I'll try to explain. I don't understand everything myself. There are things I don't know, but I'll tell you what I can."
"Thank you,"
Before she could finish, Susanna was falling again, like Alice down the rabbit hole, through the toilet, through the floor, through the pipes beneath the floor, and into another world.
9. No castle at the end of her drop, not this time. Roland had told them a few stories of his wandering years, the vampire nurses and little doctors of Illyria, the walking waters of East Down, and, of course, the story of his doomed first love. And this was a little like falling into one of those tales. Or perhaps into one of the oat operas, adult westerns, as they were called, on the still relatively new ABC TV network. Sugarfoot with Ty Harden, Maverick with James Garner, or Odetta Holmes' personal favorite, Cheyenne, starring Clint Walker. Odetta had once written a letter to ABC programming, suggesting they could simultaneously break new ground and open up a whole new audience if they did a series about a wandering Negro cowboy in the years after the Civil War. She never got an answer. She supposed writing the letter in the first place had been ridiculous, a waste of time. There was a livery stable with a sign out front reading, "Tack mended cheap." The sign over the hotel promised quiet rooms, good beds. There were at least 5 saloons. Outside one of them, a rusty robot that ran on squalling treads turned its bulb head back and forth, blaring a come-on to the empty town from the horn-shaped speaker in the center of its rudimentary face. "Girls, girls, girls! Some are Humi and some are Saibi, but who cares? You can't tell the difference. They do what you want without complaint. Won't is not in their vocabulary. They give satisfaction with every action. Girls, girls, girls. Some are Saibi, some are real. You can't tell the difference when you cop a feel. They do what you want. They want what you want." Walking beside Susanna was the beautiful young white woman with the swollen belly, scratched legs, and shoulder-length black hair. Now, as they walked below the gaudy false front of the Fetic Good Time Saloon, Bar, and Dance Emporium, she was wearing a faded plaid dress, which advertised her advanced state of pregnancy in a way that made it seem freakish, almost a sign of the apocalypse. The huaraches of the castle allure had been replaced by scuffed and battered shore boots. Both of them were wearing shore boots, and the heels clumped hollowly on the boardwalk. From one of the deserted barrooms farther along came the herky-jerky jazz of a jag-time tune, and a snatch of some old poem came to Susanna. A bunch of the boys were whooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. She looked over the batwing doors and was not in the least surprised to see the words, "Services Malamute Saloon." She slowed long enough to peer over the batwing doors and saw a chrome piano playing itself. Dusty keys popping up and down, just a mechanical music box, no doubt built by the ever-popular North Central Positronics, entertaining a room that was empty except for a dead robot and, in the far corner, 2 skeletons working through the process of final decomposition, the one that would take them from bone to dust. Farther along, at the end of the town's single street, loomed the castle wall. It was so high and so wide, it blotted out most of the sky. Susanna abruptly knocked her fist against the side of her head. Then she held her hands out in front of her and snapped her fingers. "What are you doing?" Mia asked. "Tell me, I beg." "Making sure I'm here. Physically here." "You are." "So it seems. But how can that be?" Mia shook her head, indicating that she didn't know. On this, at least, Susanna was inclined to believe her. There was no dissenting word from Detta, either. "This isn't what I expected," Susanna said, looking around. "It's not what I expected at all." "Nay?" asked her companion, and without much interest. Mia was moving in that awkward but strangely endearing duck-footed waddle that seems to best suit women in the last stages of their carry.
"And what was it you did expect, Susanna?"
"Something more medieval, I guess.
More like that."
She pointed at the castle. Mia shrugged as if to say, "Take it or leave it," and then said,
"Is the other one with you? The nasty one?"
"Detta," she meant, "of course. She's always with me. She's a part of me just as your chap is a part of you." Although how Mia could be pregnant when it had been Susanna who caught the fuck, was something Susanna was still dying to know.
"I'll soon be delivered of mine," Mia said. "Will you never be delivered of yours?"
"I thought I was," Susanna said truthfully. "She came back. Mostly, I think, to deal with you."
"I hate her."
"I know." And Susanna knew more. Mia feared Detta as well. Feared her big, big.
"If she speaks, our palaver ends."
Susanna shrugged. "She comes when she comes, and speaks when she speaks. She doesn't ask my permission." Ahead of them, on this side of the street, was an arch with a sign above it. "Fedic Station. Mono Patricia discontinued. Thumbprint reader inoperative. Show ticket. North Central Positronics thanks you for your patience." The sign didn't interest Susanna as much as the two things that lay on the filthy station platform beyond it. A child's doll, decayed to little more than a head and one floppy arm, and beyond it, a grinning mask. Although the mask appeared to be made of steel, a good deal of it seemed to have rotted like flesh. The teeth poking out of the grin were canine fangs. The eyes were glass. Lenses, Susanna felt sure, no doubt also crafted by North Central Positronics. Surrounding the mask were a few shreds and tatters of green cloth. What had undoubtedly once been this thing's hood? Susanna had no trouble putting together the remains of the doll and the remains of the wolf. Her mama, as Detta sometimes liked to tell folks, especially horny boys in roadhouse parking lots, didn't raise no fools.
"This is where they brought them," she said. "Where the wolves brought the twins they stole from Calibrin Sturgis. Where they, what, operated on them?"
"Not just from Calibrin Sturgis," Mia said indifferently, "but I. And once the babbies were here, they were taken there, a place you'll also recognize, I've no doubt."
She pointed across Fedic's single street and farther up. The last building before the castle wall abruptly ended the town was a long Quonset hut with sides of filthy corrugated metal and a rusty curved roof. The windows running along the side, Susanna could see, had been boarded up. Also along that side was a steel hitching rail. To it were tied what looked like 70 horses, all of them gray. Some had fallen over and lay with their legs sticking straight out. One or two had turned their heads toward the women's voices and then seemed to freeze in that position. It was very unhorse-like behavior, but of course, these weren't real horses. They were robots, or cyborgs, or whichever one of Roland's terms you might like to use. Many of them seemed to have run down or worn out. In front of this building was a sign on a rusting steel plate. It read, "North Central Positronics Limited, Fedic Headquarters, Arc 16 Experimental Station. Maximum security, verbal entry code required. Eye print required."
"It's another Dogon, isn't it?" Susanna asked.
"Well, yes and no," Mia said. "It's the Dogon of all Dogons, actually."
"Where the wolves brought the children."
"Aye, and we'll bring them again," Mia said, "for the king's work will go forward after this disturbance raised by your friend the gunslinger is past. I have no doubt of it."
Susanna looked at her with real curiosity. "How can you speak so cruel and yet be so serene?" she asked. "They bring children here and scoop out their heads like gourds. Children who've harmed nobody. What they send back are great galumphing idiots who grow to their full size in agony and often die in much the same way. Would you be so sanguine, Mia, if your child was borne away across one of those saddles, shrieking for you and holding out his arms?" Mia flushed, but was able to meet Susanna's gaze.
"Each must follow the road upon which Ka has set her feet, Susanna of New York. Mine is to bear my chap and raise him and thus end your Din's quest and his life."
"It's wonderful how everyone seems to think they know just what Ka means for them," Susanna said. "Don't you think that's wonderful?"
"I think you're trying to make jest of me, because you fear," Mia said levelly. "If such makes you feel better, then I have on."
She spread her arms and made a little sarcastic bow over her great belly. They had stopped on the boardwalk in front of a shop advertising millinery and ladies' wear, and across from the Fedic Dogon. Susanna thought,
Burn up the day. Don't forget that's the other part of your job here. Kill time. Keep the oddity of a body we now seem to share in that women's restroom just as long as you possibly can.
I'm not making fun, Susanna said. I'm only asking you to put yourself in the place of all those other mothers.
Mia shook her head angrily, her inky hair flying around her ears and brushing at her shoulders.
I did not make their fate, lady, nor did they make mine. I'll save my tears, thank you. Would you hear my tale or not?
Yes, please.
Then let us sit, for my legs are sorely tired.
10. In the Gin Puppy Saloon, a few rickety storefronts back in the direction from which they'd come, they found chairs which would still bear their weight, but neither woman had any taste for the saloon itself, which smelled of dusty death. They dragged the chairs out to the boardwalk, where Mia sat with an audible sigh of relief.
Soon, she said, soon you shall be delivered, Susanna of New York, and so shall I.
Maybe, but I don't understand any of this. Least of all, why you're rushing to this guy's sair when you must know he serves the Crimson King.
Hush, Mia said.
She sat with her legs apart and her huge belly rising before her, looking out across the empty street.
'Twas a man of the king who gave me a chance to fulfill the only destiny Ka ever left me. Not sair, but one much greater than he. Someone to whom sair answers. A man named Walter.
Susanna started at the name of Roland's ancient nemesis. Mia looked at her, gave her a grim smile.
You know the name, I see. Well, maybe that'll save some talk. Gods know there's been far too much talk for my taste already. It's not what I was made for. I was made to bear my chap and raise him, no more than that, and no less.
Susanna offered no reply. Killing was supposedly her trade, killing time her current chore, but in truth, she had begun to find Mia's single-mindedness a trifle tiresome, not to mention frightening. As if picking this thought up, Mia said,
I am what I am, and I am content with it. If others are not, what's that to me? Spit on him.
Spoken like Detta Walker at her feistiest, Susanna thought, but made no reply. It seemed safer to remain quiet. After a pause, Mia went on.
Yet I'd be lying if I didn't say that being here brings back certain memories. Yar.
And unexpectedly, she laughed. Just as unexpectedly, the sound was beautiful and melodic.
Tell your tale, Susanna said. This time, tell me all of it. We have time before the labor starts again.
Do you say so?
I do. Tell me.
For a few moments, Mia just looked out at the street with its dusty cover of Ogden and its air of sad and ancient abandonment. As Susanna waited for story time to commence, she for the first time became aware of the still, shadeless quality to Fedic. She could see everything very well, and there was no moon in the sky as on the castle allure, but she still hesitated to call this daytime.
It's no time,
a voice inside her whispered. She knew not whose.
This is a place between, Susanna. A place where shadows are cancelled and time holds its breath.
Then Mia told her tale. It was shorter than Susanna had expected, shorter than she wanted, given Eddie's abjuration to burn up the day, but it explained a great deal. More, actually, than Susanna had hoped for. She listened with growing rage, and why not? She had been more than raped that day in the Ring of Stones and Bones, it seemed. She had been robbed as well, the strangest robbery to which any woman had ever been subject. And it was still going on.
11.
Look out there, may it do you fine, said the big-bellied woman sitting beside Susanna on the boardwalk. Look out and see Mia before she gained her name.
Susanna looked into the street. At first, she saw nothing but a cast-off wagon wheel, a splintered and long dry watering trough, and a starry silver thing that looked like the lost rowel from some cowpoke spur. Then, slowly, a misty figure formed. It was that of a nude woman. Her beauty was blinding. Even before she had come fully into view, Susanna knew that. Her age was any. Her black hair brushed her shoulders. Her belly was flat, her navel a cunning cup into which any man who ever loved women would be happy to dip his tongue. Susanna,
Or perhaps it was Detta thought, hell, I could dip my own. Hidden between the ghost woman's thighs was a cunning cleft. Here was a different tidal pull.
That's me when I came here, said the pregnant virgin sitting beside Susanna.
She spoke almost like a woman who is showing slides of her vacation. That's me at the Grand Canyon. That's me in Seattle. That's me at Grand Coulee Dam. That's me on the FedEx High Street. Do it, please you. The pregnant woman was also beautiful, but not in the same eerie way as the shade in the street. The pregnant woman looked a certain age, for instance, late 20s, and her face had been marked by experience, much of it painful.
I said I was an elemental, the one who made love to your din, but that was a lie. As I think you suspected, I lied not out of hope of gain, but only, I don't know, from a kind of wishfulness, I suppose. I wanted the baby to be mine that way, too.
Yours from the start.
Aye, from the start, you say true.
They watched the nude woman walk up the street, arms swinging, muscles of her long back flexing, hips swaying from side to side in that eternal, breathless clock of motion. She left no tracks on the Ogun.
I told you that the creatures of the invisible world were left behind when the Prim receded. Most died, as fishes and sea animals will, when cast up on a beach and left to strangle in the alien air. But there are always some who adapt, and I was one of those unfortunates. I wandered far and wide, and whenever I found men in the wastes, I took on the form you see.
Like a model on a runway, one who has forgotten to actually put on the latest Paris fashion she's supposed to be displaying, the woman in the street pivoted on the balls of her feet, buttocks tensing with lovely, silken ease, creating momentary crescent-shaped hollows. She began to walk back, the eyes just below the straight cut of her bangs, fixed on some distant horizon, her hair swinging beside ears that were without other ornament.
When I found someone with a prick, I fucked him, Mia said. That much I had in common with the demon elemental who first tried to have congress with your so, and then did have congress with your din. And that also accounts for my lie, I suppose. And I found your din. Passing fair.
The tiniest bit of greed roughened her voice as she said this. The Detta in Susanna found it sexy. The Detta in Susanna bared her lips in a grin of gruesome understanding.
I fucked them, and if they couldn't break free, I fucked them to death.
Matter of fact, after the Grand Coulee, we went to Yosemite.
Would you tell your din something for me, Susanna, if you see him again?
Aye, if you like.
Once he knew a man, a bad man named Amos de Pape, brother of the Roy de Pape, who ran with Eldred, Jonas, and Magus. Your din believes Amos de Pape was stung to death by a snake, and in a way he was. But the snake was me.
Susanna said nothing.
I didn't fuck them for sex. I didn't fuck them to kill them, although I didn't care when they died, and their pricks finally wilted out of me like melting icicles. In truth, I didn't know why I was fucking them until I came here to Fedic. In those early days, there were still men and women here. The Red Death hadn't come, do you care? The crack in the earth beyond town was there, but the bridge over it still stood strong and true. Those folk were stubborn, trying not to let go, even when the rumors that Castle Discordia was haunted began. The trains still came, although on no regular schedule.
The children? Susanna asked. The twins? She paused.
The wolves? Nay, all of that was 24 centuries later, or more. But hear me now, there was one couple in Fedic who had a baby. You've no idea, Susanna of New York, how rare and wonderful that was in those days when most folk were as sterile as the elementals themselves, and those who weren't, more often than not, produced either slow mutants or monsters so terrible they were killed by their parents if they took more than a single breath. Most of them didn't. But this baby. She clasped her hands, her eyes shone. It was round and pink and unblemished by so much as a port wine stain. Perfect. And I knew after a single look what I'd been made for. I wasn't fucking for the sex of it, or because in coitus I was almost mortal, or because it brought death to most of my partners, but to have a baby like theirs, like their Michael.
She lowered her head slightly and said, I would have taken him, you know. Would have gone to the man, fucked him until he was crazy, then whispered in his ear that he should kill his Molly.